The Land of the Unsolved is sponsored by Spot Crime, the number one crime mapping site in the country. Make sure to visit spotcrime.com to track crime in your neighborhood, because safety begins with knowing.
Anyone who watches crime dramas could reasonably conclude that when someone is murdered, barring bizarre and extenuating circumstances, the case is solved. That is, through high-tech forensics, moral resolve, or simply the near-mythic competence of American law enforcement, killers are ultimately sent to jail. But as an investigative reporter who has worked in one of the most violent cities in the country for nearly 15 years, I can tell you, this is not true.
And that is the point of this podcast, because unsolved killings represent more than just statistics. It's a psychic toll of stories untold that infects an entire community. The final violent moments of a victim's life that remain shrouded in mystery.
I'm Stephen Janis.
I'm Taya Graham.
And we are investigative reporters who live in Baltimore City.
Welcome to the Land of the Unsolved. Hello, my name is Taya Graham, and welcome to the Land of the Unsolved. Today, we're going to be taking another look at the mysterious death of Ray Rivera. As the world knows by now, Ray's case was the subject of the hit reboot of the Unsolved Mysteries TV show on Netflix. The episode titled Mystery on the Rooftop recounted how Ray left his Baltimore home in May of 2016 and then mysteriously disappeared. Roughly 9 days later, Ray's partially decomposed body was found in the second floor conference room of the Belvedere Hotel in Baltimore. A hole in the roof above where his body was found seemed to indicate that Ray had jumped to his death. In fact, police said publicly that he had committed suicide. But Ray's family was adamant that this was not the case, pointing to myriad of evidence showing that this suicide was all but impossible. Ray was recently married to the love of his life, Allison. He had just finished a screenplay. He had recently launched his own production company, and he was planning to move back to Los Angeles to pursue his dream of being a filmmaker. Today, the goal of our show will be twofold. First, I will talk to Stephen about new documents released by the Baltimore City Police Department regarding Ray's death. Second, I will ask Stephen questions sent to him by people who watched the Unsolved Mysteries episode and are still curious about the case. So let's start. Stephen, you received what one would call a document dump of files from the Baltimore Police Department. What was in there?
Well, this is really hard to describe because, you know, when we first started investigating the case, myself and Jane Miller back in 2006 and 2007, police would not release the files related to the case, which would be the homicide files, because the case was still under investigation or considered still open. And according to the Maryland Public Information Act, it's exempt from, you know, being having to be made public. But Netflix got a hold of the documents in May of 2020, and they shared them with us. And really, you know, there's not a lot in there. You know, one of the big things that they include in these kind of document dumps are the Lotus Notes, which are basically the progress reports from homicide detectives that show what they do each and every day. And, you know, these progress reports pretty much stop abruptly in the beginning of June of 2006. So when you're reading them and it seems like the case is just getting started, there's the information just stops. They stop asking questions. You know, there's a point where they contact the owners of the garage, which is adjacent to where his body was found, to see the video camera footage. And I didn't even know there was video camera footage there. And then nothing is followed up. There is no indication of where the body was located. You know, I have my own memory of it, but there's nothing. There's not like a diagram. And I spoke to a homicide detective. He said, you know, you always do a diagram. So really, there's not a tremendous amount of evidence in there that sheds any light on anything.
So, Stephen, what was your biggest takeaway from these files?
My biggest takeaway and what I conclude from looking at them, and you know, we're going to go into more detail because we're going to follow up on some leads that the police didn't follow up on, was that somehow, for some reason, this case stopped cold. They just basically stopped it without any sort of, you know, positive evidence that it was should be stopped. You know, there were just things that weren't pursued, bank accounts, all sorts of stuff. So it seems to me like just looking at it the way it's kind of like you're reading a book and you're just getting into the beginning chapter. And then suddenly it stops as if the writer just stopped writing, as if the story just ended. And it seems like someone pulled the plug on it, you know, just like, boom, it's gone. So to me, it just, I think, sort of gives credence to the people who feel like police just let this go based on a very flimsy. So, and you know, there's really no evidence of the notes of the people they interviewed. Nobody says Ray told them they were going to commit suicide. In fact, there are people they didn't talk to that I talked to, like the last person that spoke to Ray before he died, which was, you know, a computer tech guy at an Apple service company who said, you know, he was just trying to get equipment to finish a project. So really, it seems to me that someone pulled the plug on this. That's all I can conclude.
So now we're going to go on to the questions from people who watched the Unsolved Mystery series who were very curious to see what you've uncovered. So the first question is, what are your thoughts on how the Baltimore Police Department handled the investigation? And are you aware of any case activity in recent years or any new developments since the Unsolved Mysteries release?
Okay, so I mean, if indeed Baltimore City Police Department gave us all the documents that are related to this case, I can say unequivocally that no. Nothing happened in this case after like June 3rd or 4th of 2006. And in those documents, there is no indication that they did a single thing after that period of time. And of course, you know, I have followed up with police and, you know, they are very, they're very noncommittal about anything happening since. But, you know, we went and visited the detective, the last detective, Marvin Sidnor, you know, and he indicated to us just recently after the show came out, we went and tried to talk to him, and he indicated to us that, you know, that nothing had been done. He didn't say that he'd been working on it. Of course, he's retired. But no, I think that it's pretty clear that this was stopped in June of 2006. The reason, I don't know.
So, do you have any theories about who placed the last call to Ray before he went missing, how his cell phone and eyeglasses arrived on top of the Belvedere Hotel annex undamaged, or who might have called the Baltimore City Police to inquire about his computer equipment?
Well, we know who called because that's in the police report, actually, that I just reviewed. It was people from Agora or one of the Oxford Club, one of the places, called to ask for his computer. That was from his former employer. There was no reason put in the notes, but yeah, someone from Agora or I think it was Oxford Club had called and asked because they said there was stuff he was working on for them. I think that was the reason, you know, in the notes. So we know that, but you know, we don't, the call itself, it had to have been whoever I think ended up being part of whatever happened to Ray. Right. I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, I know that some of the calls, that they found in their home line were from someone in Agora, but they don't know where. They couldn't trace them back. But, you know, and that's another interesting thing. For example, you know, there's no indication that police subpoenaed his cell phone records. In, you know, usually when you look at homicide files, there'll be subpoenas in there for cell phone records, correct? And there are no subpoenas that said, you know, requesting the cell phone records so we can get the last numbers. I don't see any indication the police tried to find out who that person was, which to me is unbelievable, you know? I mean, literally unbelievable. So, you know, you've done this kind of stuff. So, you know, you understand why that would be weird, right?
Right. For the police department not to reach out to the last person that Ray spoke to.
Well, not even look for their number.
And not even look for their number. Yeah. No, that actually is quite shocking. I'm curious, though, the second half of this question addresses how did his cell phone and eyeglasses end up on top of the Belvedere Hotel undamaged?
Right. I think that's one of the strongest pieces of evidence that he didn't jump from anywhere. Mm-hmm. Even as improbable as it sounds that there's a hole in the roof, which of course the roof is very flimsy. It wasn't, you know, wasn't well constructed. It seems more like someone had his cell phone and threw it up there because it's, you know, it's right on the concourse where he landed. And if he had that cell phone in his pocket, His glasses, when he fell from a height of, 100 meters or whatever it is, or 114 feet, there's no way it survives unscathed. I don't see how on earth it comes out of his pocket and lands unscathed next to him. To me, what that indicates is that there was a hole and they're throwing the phone and his glasses up through the hole, and right. to make it look like, or climbing up the hole or something and placing them there. It absolutely... it's like this whole case. The reason people find this case so infuriating is because none of the evidence makes any sense. That is just nonsensical. That his phone would be there unscathed. It is one of the main indicators that I believe that he didn't fall from that height.
Yes, I think it makes an excellent argument for the case that these articles were placed. I can't drop my phone 3 feet
right.
without cracking the
right,
screen.
Right, exactly. That's why we all have phone. That's a great point. That's why we all have phone protectors, right? But he somehow falls 100 feet and his phone is just sitting there with his glasses. So yeah, I think that's a big, big red flag.
Absolutely. During the previous Land of the Unsolved podcast, you shared that you were able to access the room where Ray's body was located on the day in which it was found. What was that experience like? And did you observe any traces of blood or other evidence suggesting that a body had fallen through the ceiling?
Well, so first of all, the smell, I don't think, got out of my nostrils for days and days because they had sort of tried to cover up it with some sort of chemical, but it kind of mixed with the decay. And it was a very, a troubling admixture because it just, anyone who's been to a crime scene and smelled it, and you never forget it. It's a type of smell, a decomposing body that is absolutely stifling. So that, I remember, there was a red spot over by where his body lay, because his body had been removed by the time I got back there, close to the wall. And one of the things that struck me, my memory is pretty firm that it was on the north side of the room, and which would make it closer to the top of the hotel. So it seemed to me like, how did his body end up there, like almost up against a wall, if he had jumped or been pushed off the ledge of this building? It just didn't make any sense. There, I do remember that there was paint chips and all sorts of debris around the room. I think the thing that struck me like the weirdest is there was a stencil lettering on the door of a church that I guess had been, Baltimore has a lot of storefront churches, Taya. You're aware of them, right?
Yes.
Churches that are all over the place. And someone had kind of a storefront church back there, and then they had clearly moved out. So there was like just this strange, sort of scene that just was kind of disturbing, eerie, and a weird smell. So yeah, that was what I remember.
So this is an interesting question. Detective Michael Baer, who believed the death was a homicide and that Ray's personal items appeared to be staged, was reassigned just 3 weeks into the investigation. Is it typical in homicide investigations for investigators to be reassigned?
Well, no, I don't think that's very typical. I think that's very political. When people, basically homicide's pretty orderly. You when you're up for a case, so to speak, it's sort of like you're up for the next case. That case becomes your case until, you leave the department, you retire. Generally speaking, that's the way it works, because otherwise, if people keep shuffling cases around, someone will have a disproportionate number of cases. So it's pretty orderly, and they try to keep it on a rotation. And to take someone off that case without any explicit reason, but that goes back to what I think by looking at the documents themselves, that somebody was like, hey, this is over, stop it, because the notes just stop, and it's stunning. So, I think it's extremely unusual, and I think it raises a lot of questions that I just can't answer, but yeah, no, it's very weird.
So the case is currently an open homicide investigation, and during the Dr. Oz podcast, you discussed a theory that Ray was struck by a car. What evidence do you believe most supports that Ray was murdered, and why do you think he may have been targeted?
Well, first, let me say one thing, and this clear this up. The medical examiner ruled this case undetermined, which means they couldn't determine it was a homicide or suicide, accident, or natural causes. And that means it's sitting in Baltimore City homicide as a pending case. So it's really not an open homicide case in any stretch of the imagination. The Baltimore police are more than, they have the, discretion to investigate it, but it's not on the wall, so to speak. It's not listed on the books as a homicide. Well, the most pertinent evidence, I would refer people to the podcast where we spoke to an expert in accident investigations. And what she noted was that the injuries seemed to be more severe on one side, I think on the left side of Ray's body than the right side. And she said that that would be very difficult for someone to happen if someone was falling from a height, had created the kind of hole, which is, you know, a very relatively small hole, which seemed to mean he would have to either have landed on his feet, and that the injuries would be more consistently spread across his body, that there would be injuries of his hands if he went head first.
Right.
And that it just seemed like because only one leg he was, you know, compound fracture, which is broken through, means that, you know, to her, it looked more like something she had seen from accidents where people were hit by cars, where one part of their body was traumatized and the other part wasn't. So I think, you know, given what we talked about, you know, the phone being on top of the roof, and, you know, all the questions about no one seeing him in the hotel, that, you know, the injuries, given what this forensic investigator has said, I think there you could make a good case that he was hit by a car.
I do think the forensic investigator made an excellent case that he could have been hit by a car, because the way that she described the physics of the body falling makes it highly unlikely that he could have fallen so perfectly with no damage to his hands, that he didn't put his hands out at any moment, and that the injuries were just on the left-hand side of his body. It sounds highly unusual, and I think the forensic expert made a really good point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
So how easy would it have been for a non-resident to gain access to the upper floors of the Belvedere Hotel in 2006?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Okay, so one thing that was really interesting is a couple weeks ago, Jane Miller and myself walked around there just to sort of see what you had, what you could get access to and what you couldn't. And, you know, you couldn't, to go onto the floors where people live, you have to go through an elevator and usually a security guard saying there to, if you got up to the 13th floor, which is the bar, then you would have access to the stairwells that went to the roof, I believe. However, some of those doors are locked, or you know, need some sort of key to get in. So it would be extremely difficult just to get up there, and to get someone up there who wasn't cooperating would be even harder. However, if you just wanted to get someone into that conference room, which was empty and abandoned, there are a myriad of ways from the hotel to get there, especially if you go through the parking garage, which is adjacent to the concourse where Ray was found. You can go up a set of stairs in the stairwell in the parking garage and get entrance to, I think, what seemed to us at the second level and also the living quarters. So there's like a back way in there that's pretty easy, and that would also work from the basement as well, where you could, let's say you wanted to take a body, you could take it through the basement and then up through the stairwell in the parking garage, and you know, there were more than one way. There's another stairwell we couldn't even go up, but you could get in that way, back way, much easier than I think you could get on the roof of the hotel with a person or a body.
So Ray had a well-known fear of heights, but according to the fact sheet prepared by Stansbury Research, Ray had previously visited the Belvedere rooftop to view a sunset. In your reporting, have you found that Ray has ever accessed the Belvedere rooftop prior to his death?
You know, I think I asked Allison about that, and she might have confirmed that they had wandered up there or something, but that doesn't mean he didn't have fear of heights, because I can tell you this much. His brother, Angel, one of the first things he said to me when I was working on the story in 2006 or 7, after you know his body had been found, was that Ray didn't even like to climb the top of the Christmas tree and put the Christmas ornaments up there.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
he was extremely scared of heights, and that was one of the first things he said, like, there's no way you get Ray up to the top of that building. You know, the people, and you know, it's very interesting because anyone who's been up to the top of that hotel, it's really scary. It's like, you know, there's all these things around, and it just seems like you could, if you have vertigo, you don't want to go up there. Let's put it that way. But just the fact that he went up there doesn't mean he wasn't scared of heights. Pretty much everyone who knows him said he was scared of heights. So that's absurd. That's just absurd.
So in the Land of the Unsolved podcast, you mentioned an email you received stating that Ray was a whistleblower and that he did not commit suicide. Did the email include any other information?
Actually, you know, I've received a lot of emails with, I would say, you know, sort of non-specific information, very, you know, information that Ray was, you know, a whistleblower, that Ray knew something, that people wanted to keep him quiet. But you know, when you try to drill down and say, okay, so then who, what did he know? And that those answers are, you know, not of substantial enough for me to say something, right? Because if I don't want to speculate. You know, I understand that people want answers in this case, but I'm a reporter, so I'm not going to like just throw out, you know, something that someone sent me on Twitter or Facebook. I appreciate the contextual information, but I don't have any proof. But I would say that there is a certain amount of people who have been sort of sharing with me the idea that Ray had stumbled onto something or had some information that someone wanted kept secret. So I can say that that's definitely consistent, but I can't point to anything specific because I haven't given anything specific and I haven't confirmed it. So it would be irresponsible to say anything.
You have said you believe that there was sufficient evidence for the medical examiner to reach a conclusion other than... You have said you believe there was sufficient evidence for the medical examiner to reach a conclusion other than undetermined. Which evidence do you think most supports that in the autopsy report?
Well, as you know, I think now that we have this accident investigation, you know, this forensic investigator that said that, you know, she believes the injuries are not consistent with a fall, that, you know, it's to me, it's kind of stunning because here we have this person across, you know, pretty much across the ocean who came up with these concepts and ideas. And you think to yourself, why didn't they investigate him? They're sitting there, they're looking up at this hole and they've got these injuries. Why didn't someone like put this two and two together? Like I can't even, like I said, I can't even answer questions concretely about where the body was. It feels like they just left so many things unanswered. And had they drilled down a little bit and said, you know, wait a second, he's got injuries on one side. He's only got one compound fracture. How on earth could he have fallen from a height and only compound fracture one of his legs? That they could have, you know, ruled this a homicide. And the suicide evidence is so flimsy. There's just no evidence. This man was, as you pointed out, Taya, was leading, you know, a great life. He's just married, you know, finished a screenplay. So, you know, in the absence of evidence, you can't just say, oh, it's a suicide. I think undetermined was a cop-out. I think they should have. There was plenty of evidence that Ray Rivera had no intention of dying that day. Therefore, it's at the hands of another, right?
Now, reconstruction testing was reportedly performed from the Belvedere rooftop with the use of a dummy. Do you know if any testing has been conducted involving the parking garage?
None that I know of. And, you know, one of the things that was interesting with the forensic expert we talked to, she said if he had come off the parking garage, there's no way he would have been able to, where he landed, create that kind of vertical drop hole. So none that I know of, but I mean, there are a lot of people that speculate. For example, if he was hit by a car thrown into the air, could he have, you know, landed on the roof? Or could something have happened in the parking garage? But no one, I think, so the only thing I know is that this particular person we talked to claimed that if he had come from the parking garage, that the hole itself would not have been shaped like it was because he had been moving with so much horizontal force that it would have been a longer hole or more elongated, you know, break in the roof.
Tom Hickling, who did some work for the same company and was a friend of Ray's, also died under questionable circumstances just 5 months prior to Ray's death. What do you know about Ray and Tom's relationship, and do you believe their deaths could be connected?
Oh, you know, that's what's so interesting because, you know, Tom Hickling, he dies in Africa, you know, completely out of sight in circumstances that, you know, some say a car accident, but certainly murky. And I think that the connection is that both their deaths are murky and his death is murky. And certainly, you know, I've looked into it and I've tried to find information, but there's not that much information on it because it didn't happen here.
Right.
It happened, you know, in a country where the media is a little different, although, you know, I can't give us too much credit because we haven't solved this case. But you know, there wasn't much of what we got was second or third hand. But I do think it's very disturbing that two people who worked pretty in somewhat some proximity die under very mysterious circumstances, non, you know, natural causes within that period of time is extremely disturbing.
How have your thoughts on the case evolved since you began covering it 14 years ago? And which facts do you feel are the most compelling?
Well, you know, I never really thought that Ray Rivera committed suicide. And
right.
I think that over time, that's only become more firm. And just seeing the way people reacted to the case by watching the show, you know, it was pretty lonely here. I mean, I would urge everyone to read the Baltimore Sun article that sort of gave Porter Stansberry the chance to respond, although he would not talk to us or wouldn't talk to Unsolved Mysteries, to let you know what kind of, you know, journalism atmosphere we deal with here, Taya, right, in Baltimore. I mean, that was basically, you know,
it was like a press release for Porter Stansberry. Yeah, it essentially outlined everything Porter Stansberry wanted the public to believe with very little pushback.
With no pushback whatsoever. And so what was affirming to me was that most of the people who have watched the show believe that Ray did not commit suicide. And so I've only become more firm. And I think, you know, the fact that now, number one, they stopped this case cold in its tracks. Number two, all the information missing from the police file, all the things that should have been done, like where was the body positioned? You know, were the injuries consistent with this type of fall? It's very specific, right? A very small hole with a body laying against a wall should produce certain injuries that can be, I think, you know, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but there should be a certain type of... So there is more information now than ever that this was not a suicide, which means this case needs to be reopened as a homicide.
I also think the article that you were mentioning also mm-hmm. shows how local media, and it's not just Baltimore City, this is other towns as well, often go along with the politics of the law enforcement. I think this article that you mentioned shows that a problem that happens with a lot of local media, which is that they fall in line with whatever their local law enforcement wants them to, that mm-hmm. the local media Definitely. Bolsters the narrative of the local law enforcement and does not push back against it. And essentially, the law enforcement is telling us to accept their judgment, don't ask any questions, this case needs to remain closed, it's a homicide, we called it, leave it alone. Yeah. And essentially, the Stansberry article reaffirmed that, and it's incredibly disappointing because investigative reporting is absolutely essential to bringing these things to light, and unfortunately, there's a lot of local media that simply goes along to get along. And now for your last question. You recently indicated that you might be working on a project related to the case. Can you share any details about that or any other upcoming projects you're working on?
Well, you know, Jane and I have been working kind of together to do some sort of long form work on this. And, you know, I know she's working on some other stuff. I can only say at the moment that, you know, I'm trying to put everything together and piece everything together I can to do sort of, you know, a larger piece that will put this all in context and, you know, explore every piece of evidence and follow up. And now that I've got the police report, there's a lot of stuff to follow up on. I think to a certain extent, I will say this. I think that the police report gives enough space for things to be followed up that they didn't follow up on. And I think the forensic piece that we did is part one, but part two, Tay and I are going to keep looking into it and keep working on it. So, there will be more to come. Let's say that.
Thank you for joining us for The Land of the Unsolved. The Land of the Unsolved is produced for Ace Spectrum Productions. It is edited by my co-host, Stephen Janis. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider hitting the support button and donating. Every penny counts. Also, if you'd like to read more of our work in print, Stephen and I have written 3 books on policing, all available on Amazon. Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore. You Can't Stop Murder? Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond. And The Book of Cop. A Testament of Policing That Works. All are available on Amazon.com. My name is Taya Graham, and thank you so much for joining us for The Land of the Unsolved.